Your mother was a test, and then there was you. Would you like to try this over again?
I love it.
Oh, God. Go.
Sounds good.
It sounds cute, yeah.
Okay.
Right. When do you want to touch me?
Okay, let's start this again.
Are we ready?
What factors or influences have contributed to your development as an artist?
You know, I'm going to be myself, so, you know, if I tell you about my bad leg first. What I was going to say before I was rudely interrupted was that, as far as I recall, my old lady told me that in second grade, which I don't know how old I would have been, to make up an age, was that this teacher called her in and said, there's something wrong with that boy, or something like that, I don't know. But in any event, they said that I was ready to specialize at that age. What would that have been?
Seven, something like that, whatever.
They said that, you know, that they should start searching for an outlet for my whatever. So I went to art school. I went to, my mother wanted to buy me an instrument, send me to ballet school if I wanted to, drama, what have you. Well, as you well know, I started to play guitar at 8 or 9 years old. Actually, I took my first piano lesson when I was 5, but that's beside the point. So I started to play guitar and whatnot, and I don't know if any of the music I could say influenced me in becoming an artist at that given time, because I think at that age it's anyone that tells you that composed from the age 5 or whatever, I think it's all bullshit. I don't think kids at that age are capable of having the understanding of whether they're an artist or not. I think that's rather ridiculous. But in any event, it seems to me that when I started writing music, I still didn't even know what I was doing. I was just doing something that was enjoyable for me. I remember I used to hear a song on the radio and rewrite the whole thing, sing a different melody to the harmony, do all sorts of crazy things. I spent a lot of time just walking through the woods, making up tunes, and when I learned to read music, I'd jot them down. Do I still have those? No, I threw away boxes and boxes of that stuff when I was a kid. But I kept writing, I kept practicing, I kept whatever. Well, I remember, I guess I was in about maybe 9th or 10th grade, I don't recall. I was writing one day, still, I didn't know what the hell a composer was. And this person who was at that time a band director, of course I didn't play a band instrument in the music department at the high school I went to, wasn't for shit, so it was rather a useless thing, but rather a minimal marching band. But he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm writing down this song, and this piece of music that I have heard in my head. I'm figuring it out on my guitar. I'm putting it down on paper. So, well, let me take a look at it. So I showed it to him. He said, well, do you do this often? And I said, well, do I do it often? I've been doing it since I was 10 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old. I don't know. He said, well, do you have more of this stuff? Well, hell, I brought boxes of that stuff in I had. And he looked at me and he said, do you know what it is to be a composer? And I said, I don't have any idea. I said, do you mean like Beethoven or whoever? You know, I know those people were composers. Somebody, there was some of that music around the house. Well, he immediately started to teach me eurythmics, that was the study of rhythm, and a bit about harmony and counterpoint, so forth and so on. I'd learned to read music better. I mean, I didn't even know my key signatures. I had been writing and knew nothing of what I was doing. So I started out, if you want to consider that an artist at that age, a very blind one to the fact that I didn't even know what the hell an artist was. And I don't think many people did in Atlanta, and I still don't think they do today, but that's beside the point. So in any event, I started to study harmony and counterpoint on my own. There wasn't a teacher to be found, so there was no influence. Other than at the point, I guess I was around 16 or so, And I discovered the music of Stravinsky and the music of Edgar Varèse. He was French, well, American composer. They credit him, but he was born in France. But in particular, a work called Arcana, which was a very large orchestral work. And when everyone else was listening to the Beatles and all their little rock and roll tunes, which I couldn't stand, I was trying to hotwire my radio to get the BBC and listen to more classical music, still totally unsupervised, but the music that was in my ears was comparable to this Varèse tune, or this Varèse orchestra piece called Arcana, which it took me several years to get a recording of it. I had heard it, I don't even recall where I had heard it, but I finally got a recording of it and I'd listened to it night and day. So I guess for the first influence it would have been Edgar Varèse, but also the works of Stravinsky.
What was that?
It was a tough one, but it was my mother. Then I heard The Rite of Spring and so forth and so on, and when I got still in high school, I listened to also a lot of jazz, and the one person in particular would be Eric Dolphy, who is just one of the craziest sax players you ever heard in your life. He's madness. I should play some of his music with him. Also John Coltrane. But these were very heavy black jazz sax players. And I would listen to... I never listened to guitars. I never did. I found most guitars rather boring, and still do. And so on my instrument, I practiced and I improvised and I did whatever I felt and heard in my ear. Okay, speaking of still influence, I have four now, so it would have been Varèse, Stravinsky, Coltrane, and Eric Dolphy. I guess then I moved to Nashville for a year, and then I discovered the music of Anton Webern, which was, I heard his short string quartets. I don't know the German name for it, I can get it for you, but it was, there's six very short string quartets. They're, the longest is maybe 30 seconds. Well, that just moved me to tears. I mean, that really was my jumping off point, was the music of Anton Webern, who was assassinated in World War II. Those string quartets just blew my mind. I'd been hearing music like that in my head as far back as I can remember. I was a child, and I finally found home, basically. And then I was at one point in a grocery store in Nashville, Tennessee, and they used to have these huge record bins, as big as, bigger than a classroom. I mean, it was just a huge, where they throw all these records for a dollar. Well, one night we'd got good and crocked and went over to the store, figured we'd look for records, and I was passing through this record thing, and I ran across a work of Charles Warren's with a big fat sticker on it saying, as seen on TV, which I got quite a kick out of, because the thing that was intriguing about it was in the liner notes, he was referring to Webern and late Stravinsky and Milton Babbitt, who I didn't know at that time, who I ended up studying with, as you know, Elliot Carter, Arnold Schoenberg, but the thing that hit me was that he was speaking of Webern, and Webern was my newfound hero, I guess you could say, and so I bought it. I think they had a sale, I got it for 89 cents, but... I took it home, and it was his cello concerto. I bought two albums, but the first one was his chamber concerto for cello and 10 players. Well, I was just completely blown away. It was just unbelievable. And this was a man that was alive, because Webern was dead. Stravinsky died in 71. Varèse died in 65. The masters who I was being heavily influenced by, Dolphy was dead, Coltrane was dead. I had liked the music of Don Ellis, who was a big band jazz person, but very modern. He had died. So everyone was dead, but here was an opportunity to meet somebody that I could have an interchange with. Well, I went to the dean of the music school at Peabody in Nashville and said, do you know who this Warini guy is? I didn't even know how to pronounce the fucker's name because he was Finnish composer as Warren, but an odd spelling, W-U-O-R-I-N-E-N, I didn't know. Well, he said, Charles wrote the liner notes for my first symphony. I said, well, you know the guy. You know, this was unbelievable here in Nashville. Who the hell would know who Charles Warner was, especially because of the music, 12-tone composer, extremely dissonant, really what I was interested in. In fact, it reminds me, I remember a teacher way back when I was about 16 or 17 asked me if I was a serial composer, which I had no idea even what that meant. Here I was writing in sequences as a 12-tone composer, using all 12 notes in a certain pattern set up in a row form, but I didn't even know what it was. Well, it turns out that Charles Warner was coming to Nashville to give a symposium on a piece that he wrote called Contrafactum, which was the orchestration of Times Encomium, the electronic work that he won the Pulitzer Prize for. Of course, I was freaked. I said to you, can you introduce me to this person? Or would you introduce me to this person, whatever the case? Well, sure, he said, why not? You know, Charles is going to be down here. Well, he went to the... He gave the symposium, and I went up to... Gil Trythall was the dean. I don't know where the hell he was now. He was the dean at the University of West Virginia after that, but he since left or was fired or what have you. I met Charles Warner, and I said, would you mind looking at a few of my scores? And he said, it was very nice. He said, sure. And turns out he was on the faculty of Manhattan School of Music, which is a whole other story. But in any event, I took my scores to him. And he told me that I had great potential, blah, 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 so forth and so on. And I actually quit school to come to New York to study with him. So I guess the first major influence of persons that I was able to be with and talk to was Charles Warren. But I don't know if necessarily, I guess it has been an odd relationship between him and I, and you know why. I won't go into that. But
okay, but let me ask you, early on, though, there was really, you never... were fascinated with anything else. There never seemed to be a question of some other path.
The only other thing I was ever fascinated with was nature, which I still am. I hunt and I fish. I was always completely fascinated with wildlife. I could spend hundreds of hours watching squirrels crack nuts open. Animals have always intrigued me more than people, don't ask me why, but I've always had felt a much deeper bond with wild animals than I have with people. I guess that's why I hang out with wilder people, but in any event, I spent many hours fishing, catching poisonous snakes, building forts in the woods. I guess I was the mountain man without a mountain.
Okay.
And that's actually would have been... The only other course I would have taken would have probably become a zoologist.
Okay. Did you do those things alone? Or did you have friends?
I always felt that the people that I knew as friends, they liked nature, but they didn't respect it. They had no respect for it. They didn't seem to... are we coming through? They didn't... Well, they... I had, my brother got to a point where he'd go so far into the woods, but he'd be afraid to go any further. I was always wanted to go to places in the woods where it was dark and scary, and that didn't bother me, you know, I loved it. There was a definite line where that my friends wouldn't cross in going into the woods deeper as children, exploring way back into the wilderness. I guess the boogeyman was going to get him or what have you. And one fellow was named Jay Miles. I don't know where he is today. We spent a lot of time together with my brother and he and a few other people. But I always took great risks as a kid. I didn't care, you know, and I still do to this day, you know.
Let me interrupt, though, Tom, and let me ask you. Would you say then you would consider that you're still developing as an artist?
I think if you ever stop, you dry up and die.
Okay.
I don't think you can.
Okay. So you're still developing. You're still growing. Right?
Well, I think that if you are ever... Well, I'll give you an answer to that. In the idea that when you stop growing that you become satisfied with what you do, then you're, in a sense, if you say, well, I'm satisfied with that, I don't need to do anything else. Well, I think that's when the creativity stops.
Okay,
do turn the switch off.
Okay, then what is influencing you now? Instead of being retrospective, let's look at now. What are your convictions now about your, you know, a little of the way you spoke last week?
Yeah. What did I you know, say? And how much did I drink?
Well, maybe it wasn't last week. Maybe it was the week before. But a little, you know, about what are contributing issues right now, and you know, the way you were talking about your position in relationship to society or to what are your struggles. You know, you were talking a bit about the financial struggles, yet that it's all worth it on one level, but that at the same time it has its harder times. But that, you know, let's look at the present.
Yeah, with the harder, well, and no, the only thing I say about the harder times is it's frustrating for me because, see, I would write all the time. That this is just something I do. I really care little about most everything except for creating more music. Although I care very deeply to get it performed and get it heard, have it be heard by every person. I'm not a closet composer in that respect. I really care for people to hear it, and I do think about audience. Not that it influences the work by any means, but I do want my music heard. It's my life. It's blood. I cut a piece of my heart off every time and put it in music, and I want to share that with people, bad and good. But,
do you feel that there's something in it for them? Or that they can learn from that, or that they're, you know, what makes you want it to be heard?
Well, I've always looked at it as that everyone, I think every intellectual being has some type of an outlet that needs to be, or has a need, I should say, to have their life uplifted. I think culture in a lot of forms, everyone has a point that of their mind that needs satisfying. I think that for some people they're extremely limited, and you could probably throw them a scrap of cheese and they'd be satisfied. But there's other, I don't think that my music will reach everybody. I think it'd be silly to think that. I think my music is much too difficult for the average person to except now at this time. That's not to say that when man becomes, hopefully, when man becomes more intellectual, or there's more intellectual men, let's put it that way, that maybe my music will have a broader appeal. But I think that if my music can touch two or three people, I've done my duty to God and man. It's that I've helped change somebody's life. I've helped it be a better life. I don't know how it does that, because I can't tell you what you like in music, and what I like in music might be two different things. You may like the same piece, but there will be other pieces that we don't. But back to the influence thing, which you asked me about it for now, is that I derive most my greatest influence and power out of my own music. And that's not to say I sit around all day and listen to my pieces, but I've been lucky in the fact that 99% of my music has been performed, so I learn from myself continually. Mm-hmm. I find myself listening to less and less music of not only my colleagues, but of composers that are no longer with us. But I go back and listen to a piece every now and then. I have resurgence. Sometimes I'll listen to Berez a lot. Sometimes I'll listen to nobody. Sometimes I'll listen to a little Eric Dolphy. Sometimes I'll listen to somebody else. But I think...
Little Allman Brothers.
There you
go.
Anything. That's one thing I must say. I've listened to just about every kind of music. And I think that I seem to listen to a lot of garbage simply because it's very mindless music, and I can throw it over the background and I don't have to think about it. I seem to, when I listen to Schoenberg or Webern or Berg or Stravinsky or Verez or Warren or whatever, I don't listen to it to listen to it. My mind starts to pick it apart, and because it's closer, it's hitting closer to home, that I hear something, I want to know why it works. I guess if it was a mathematician who might add simple figures on a grocery list, but if he sees an algebra problem laying on the floor, he stops dead and tries to pick it apart or something like that. It's closer to home if he's into higher math. Mm-hmm. So what would be the enjoyment of listening to the particular piece. We'll drop the word enjoyment. It's part of my life. It's a part of my business. It's my job. I write music. It's what I do. And so I tend to want to pick it apart. It's, for instance, like an architect sees a building that he didn't build. He kind of wants to go inside and look how the structure is and try to figure out how the hell this is and how the guy got his idea or whatever the case may be. In other words, I listen to it very analytically instead of just to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to listen to too much music. I'm very concerned with my own, I guess. I've always been a person that, the music I listen to, I write. The food I would like to eat, which I don't all the time because I can't have the opportunity to do it, I'd rather kill all my food and eat it and grow all my own stuff. I'd rather build the house that I live in. I'm just that kind of person. Putting down hard cash for something that I know I can make better. It's the way I've always been.
Let me ask you then, speaking of solitude, how has solitude been an aspect of your development?
I guess if creating a product or a piece of music is your development, that would mean that solitude is the only way that I can produce the product, because I can't write a piece of music I have been writing a piece of music while I'm having a conversation. I know I've done it before, but I can compose under any conditions. I can compose the radio on, the TV on, with people talking to me. I seem to be able to do that. Although, as of late, when there's nobody around, so forth and so on, I guess you have to have it quiet to write. So you can ask yourself many questions, but I guess solitude comes with the territory. So yeah. I don't question it. Yeah.
Okay, but solitude is not necessarily quietude, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's
also not prostitute. Oh, excuse me.
I guess it's a sense of being...
Alone?
Well, alone, cut off from others.
Do I feel cut off from others? No, not really. Do I feel alone from others?
Yeah.
In the sense that I don't think that I'm very well understood. I don't think people understand what I do, even if I explain it to them. For instance, somebody will ask me, how do you write a piece of music if you don't have a piano? Well, I've always written it in my head. I've just put it down on paper. I mean, I sketch heavily, but people go, oh, that's impossible. Well, for them it probably is impossible, but then on the other hand, is I can't explain why I hear music in my head, and I have since I was a child, and it's what I've decided to do, and it's really all I know how to do, and it's all I've addressed in my entire life is writing music. I don't question it. I think if I wasted the time questioning it, like 90% of the jerks who like to call themselves composers that aren't, and they prove it in the fact that they always question it, but they never get any music written. I've written one symphony. I've written six in my head. I've written more than one requiem in my own mind. I've written many chamber pieces, several string quartets, which I hope that I will put on paper someday. I've completed works 2 years ago that I still haven't written yet.
But they're in there. You can recall them,
yeah,
or you can dredge them up.
I kind of compose in reverse. I tear the piece apart and put it back together again. I don't build, I work in reverse. Although you tell somebody that and they tell you that it's impossible, you're out of your mind, you're lying, you're pretending, you're this, that, and the other, well, fucker, you know, because it's just the way I do it.
Okay, well then, would you say then there was some psychological disparity? That's sort of, in a way, what you were describing, that... the world as you perceived it, and maybe your own inner world is different and less likely to be easily communicated to others.
Well, it is. Well, first off, it's frustrating in the fact that I don't have more time to write. That's a problem, because I have to make a living to the point where hopefully I will just be paid to write music, but that may be way off. But I don't know. Say again.
You sort of said it earlier about...
Well, other things that influence, I think that I get... I have a great... I still have this great rapport with nature, there's respect, and I think that when I go out and I hunt and I fish, I sort things out in a lot of detail, and I need that time to do it. It's very funny, when I go out hunting or shooting or fishing or what have you, I seem to come back refreshed by way of just that I've been able to sort things out. And I must say some of the sorting out is totally subconscious, too. It just seems to... I think that everything that goes on in my life affects my music, people I know, where do I live, what I do, so forth and so on.
So then that all finds its way into...
I don't think you can keep it from not finding its way. If you do, I think you're consciously trying to manipulate your situation in creating a piece that is really not truly, that has been castrated in some sense. It's not 100% you. A lot of people sit down and try to write completely, I've been called an academic, I've been called a performance composer, I've been called an asshole, I've been called a lot of things. But I have a very strong fuck you attitude. And I have had that ever since I was a child, is that I know what I do, I believe in what I do, I think that it's my sanctuary, it's my religion, I feel close. I mean, it's how I worship God. I mean, I feel that He creates this, in some sense, I feel that I've gone so far as to say, before that there's also a remote possibility or a possibility or a very good possibility, whatever, that he may write the music and put it through me. Maybe that's why I hear it in detail all written, and all I have to do is make the finite revisions and put it on paper. See, I don't write in any I don't write in revisions. I write final products. I do sketches, but when it hits the page, it's there forever. And I don't change. I think that in an orchestra piece that might have 20,000 notes, if I change two or three notes out of all that, it's a lot for me.
Huh. From the initial writing out.
Yeah, it's a lot. I can go 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 pieces and not change one note, and then there might be one piece where I might change 5 or 6 notes or something like that. But for instance, I just finished the first symphony. I know for a fact I think I changed maybe 4 notes out of all 3 movements. That was about all that needed to be done. There was 1 rhythmic adjustment. That was about it. Sometimes I'll hear a work for orchestra and then rewrite it for a smaller group and come back and write it for the larger group later on. Depends on the piece. Now that I got off the beaten track.
It's not off the beaten track. It's really... about it, this was a brief thing.
Okay.